When I was in Ecuador particularly, I got involved with some of the mystery sites out there that connect to this idea of, a possible lost civilization that's been, buried by the jungle. And so, some people might have read about this, but there was a site in the Yanganates jungle, which is it's a particularly hazardous area of the Ecuadorian jungle. And where you may have heard of this is for the story of the lost treasure of the Inca. Because when they basically executed Atahualpa, his brother took half, this rumor knowing, took half of the treasure that was en route to the Spanish, and he diverted into the Yanganates, which is essentially swamps, mountains, freezing fogs. It's just a really harsh environment. So, for the Spanish to go in and find this treasure, pretty impossible. But in that same area, what's been discovered is a peculiar megalithic wall. So we're not going to look this up. It was covered in, I think it was the Telegraph, that we ended up going a couple of expeditions into this site where you've got essentially very similar stonework to, you'd see at the megalithic sites in Peru, which is not surprising in that, it borders with Ecuador, of course. But this site is deep into a jungle area where there should be no civilizations, right? The other thing I noticed is between the blocks, there was a kind of mortar. And the Peruvians, like all of the known sites with polygonal megalithic blocks, have no mortar, right? They're all just perfectly fitted together. There's the story, you can't put a razor blade between them and all that. But well, this had mortar, and that's really weird, because it means this is not the same culture, but it's a very similar style. I believe it's older. I think that what we're seeing here is a site that has been, completely lost to time, overgrown by the jungle, and that could possibly go back to the 12,000 years, time range where we've got this kind of the great devastation at the end of the Younger Dryas. A destroyed megastructure made of silica, that could leave traces. Engineering the genome of humans should leave traces. And a multi-directional bombardment, that's got to leave traces, yeah? And so I thought to myself, well, look, I'm not going to come out straight away and talk about this until I check these enough. So over a period of time, I did a deep dive. And I was frankly astonished to find that, yeah, there is this mysterious rain of glass, of silica glass, that occurs 788,000 years ago. It's called the Australasian Tektite Strewn Field. And for over 130 years, scientists have been trying to understand the exact cause of this glassy rain.
Now, before we jump into the topic of this conversation, just want to make everyone aware that I've recently been demonetized on YouTube. I will be able to reapply for monetization on the 26th of November, but until then, YouTube has turned the tap off in terms of being able to make advert revenue, which was quite a significant portion of my income on a monthly basis. I've had a really amazing outpour of support from people via PayPal, Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, contributing to try and help me get through this short little process of demonetization on YouTube. And I just want to say thank you so much to all of you that have already donated and given what you can. It's really much appreciated. Anyone else who's able to do that to help support my work whilst I kind of navigate through this brief period of demonetization on YouTube, that would be much appreciated. They didn't give me a solid reason why I was demonetized. It was apparently a copyright infringement, but they didn't specify the video. I tried to reappeal and they denied my reappeal. So yeah, that's my situation right now.
Let's get into, for the last half an hour or so, the Australite Tektite mystery. Now, we did a podcast on this a while back. I'd recommend people check that out because we dedicated pretty much the entire time to it. But for those who aren't familiar, this is pretty interesting. So I'd love for you to just take some time to break it down.
Sure, and I'll give a very brief background to how this came about. Because it was a strange kind of detour, So I think most people have a sense now, my background and things I've been involved with, mostly ancient mysteries, human stories, how we moved around. These were topics that I was fascinated with. But what happened to me was after becoming involved with this lost site in Ecuador, that led on to, because I ended up in the press. It was kind of picked up by Science Channel, and then they invited me across to Georgia. I went on this Science Channel thing where we had to go find some giant bones up in the Caucasus. And then from there, I kind of ended up, during that period, I should say, I ended up connecting with some Australian researchers, Stephen Evan Strong, who were aware of this claim that there'd been a visitation event in Australia, that there was this, you know, there's a book basically called Outer Ring, When the First Ancestors Were Created. And in it, there is this story about a visitation event, modifying of humans stuff, that was allegedly given to a group of people who encountered an ancient Aboriginal artifact and went through a kind of, I suppose we'd call it mystical telepathic kind of experience, where it seemed that this artifact was intelligent and that they were given this story. Now, it's a wild claim, of course, wild sounding claim, you know, talking Aboriginal artifact, telling them about a lost visitation by aliens. But the thing is, some of what they were saying in the story matched some personal experiences we'd had, because I actually had had, myself and my wife had had what I would call contact with some kind of intelligence. That began 2011. After I went to Egypt, I visited Cairo and was at a special site there. I'm trying to think what's called now. Not far from the pyramids, anyway. There's a kind of sun temple ruin. And, you know, whilst I was there, I had this really strange experience where I was trying to draw towards the Pleiades and had this kind of, I guess you'd call it kind of a internal conversation with something that I couldn't see, you know. So again, I kind of psychical experience that there was some kind of intelligence in the direction of the Pleiades that was aware and interacting at that site. So, and strange as that sounds, that was my experience. And I was almost having a conversation of, you know, why have you, you know, disconnected from this world? You know, why aren't you here helping? You know, this world's a mess. And that was the kind of, it just came up from nowhere. I can't explain it. Now, nothing immediately happened. But about 2 months after that, my now wife, Danielle, then not my wife, but she was my friend, she started having intelligent contact with entities or intelligences that suggested that they were linked with the Pleiades. So we'd had these really intense experiences were going on. So this is why when I heard about this story of a Pleiades connection and this visitation, you know, I didn't just dismiss it. I thought, well, hang on a minute, you know, this kind of seems to link with things that we've had going on in our personal lives. So I'm going to look at it and see whether there's maybe something here, something to it, and something I could validate. And I sort of said to myself, I won't go talking about this story unless I can validate some of the core claims in this book, Outer Ringo, When the First Ancestors Were Created. So actually it's published 2003. Right. So it's got a timestamp on it as well. So nobody can add in, you know, new details. You know, that's what they claimed was said. And so I took the information from the book and I went looking for the core claims. And now the core claims are that there was an enormous ship, essentially a crystalline ship, a living AI ship that arrived here and was destroyed in orbit. And they described material melting, raining down across the landscape. I thought, well, you know, that could leave traces, you know, enormous like mega structure raining down silica melt glass. So that was one of the main ones. They also said that some of the survivors came down, modified people in Australia. So again, this is happening above Australia, that the survivors come down at a place called Gosford, and that they then realized they can't survive here, that they need their genetic engineering technologies to modify themselves, that this is something that was in process before their craft is destroyed. And again, I thought, well, that's very logical, because you hear these stories about aliens just, you know, walking around, you know, on Earth, or, and you think, well, how could they, right? Different air, different gravity, you know, different bacterial environment. But here we're getting a logical explanation. It's like, well, no, we don't just land and live there. Now, en route, we've already started re-engineering ourselves so that we can live there. And the destruction of the main science lab on the ship means that we can't do that, that it's game over, and that we're all unsuited. And they said it's sort of dying. You know, the radiation is killing them. The air isn't right, that they're not ready to live there. So they come up with this secondary idea that instead of colonizing Earth, they will colonize via the existing hominins by changing them to be more like themselves and giving them their thinking, culture, and their identity, essentially, right? So this is a kind of proxy colonization instead of a proxy war that we have these days. So we have a proxy colonization event. So I thought, that's kind of fascinating, because that's a narrative you don't hear much in these kind of aliens claims. Again, made some sense as to why they're doing this. And then the third part of this was a claim that 5 years after this event, that they have a follow-up mission from other beings that are allied with them, who turn up and are basically like a cosmic police almost. They're like, you know, this ship's been destroyed. You know, the beings have done it. You know, they're in these other underground bases on Earth. They're a negative kind of presence. They've ambushed one of our alliance ships and we're going to pulverize them. They sort of warn them, get off the planet or else. They said the ones who don't leave we unleash a bombardment from space. But this is not an ordinary bombardment. They pull in asteroids and bombard the planet with asteroids. Again, that's a wild claim if it wasn't real, right? Because that should leave traces. So the thing I took from the book was these three major things. I thought, well, a destroyed megastructure made of silica, that could leave traces. Engineering the genome of humans should leave traces. And a multi-directional bombardment, right? That's got to leave traces, yeah? And so I thought, I said, well, look, I mean, I'm not going to come out straight away and talk about this until I check these enough. So over a period of time, I did a deep dive. And I was frankly astonished to find that, yeah, there is this mysterious rain of glass, of silica glass, that occurs 788,000 years ago. It's called the Australasian Tektite Strewn Field. And for over 130 years, scientists have been trying to understand the exact cause of this glassy rain. And so there's been a lot of different hypotheses. The two main ones were an impact of a very large object somewhere in Indochina. And you've got to explain the material going up into space, raining down across 10,000 kilometers, right? So you need a really exotic event, an impact that launches things into space, and somehow they come back at the right angles. So that was one argument. Another argument was that an impact on the moon launched lunar glass across and it rained down, right? But so you had these really exotic arguments to try to explain it. Now, then on the other side, you had this multi-directional bombardment. And that was a bit of a problem. So I was like, well, I've never heard of that. And I thought, well, if that's real, surely we'd have all heard of it. Because it's like, you know, we all hear about the dinosaur impact event. You know, we're aware of these kinds of mega destruction events. They're usually Nat Geo specials and stuff, right? So I was kind of surprised. I thought, well, maybe it's not real. Maybe, you know, again, I found one thing that seems to fit. But, you know, maybe that's just a bit of luck. You never know. And then I found actually, in 2016, keep in mind the book was published in 2003, so it cannot be added to the claims, right? So anything that it could be known at the time, you can argue she took it from the, you know, something like that, right? You can say, well, maybe you just cherry-picked it. The fact is, in 2016, a team of geologists identified a multi-directional impact event, and they found what seems to be an asteroids hitting in Central America, Canada, like Laos, Tasmania, and I think there might be one other, that they said got multiple impacts. And when they tested the materials at the sites, they concluded not only that it seemed like the dates were so close that they were probably part of one event, but the materials were sort of significantly different, so they couldn't be part of one object. So if someone might say, well, you know, this is a comet, you know, like a meteorite breaking up or a comet breaking up, it causes a swarm. No, these are distinct objects coming in from different sides of the planet at the same time. And that is really weird, because you don't have that happening. Usually one large object hits every, I think it's every 100,000 years. You get one large bombardment, right? But you don't get several of them coming in at the same time from different sides. That straight away stood out to me. Even, they don't really say in the paper, but it's obviously weird, right? It's just obviously weird that would be happening. Why would that happen? And then, so I thought, well, you've got now two really strange, mysterious events. This glassy rain that nobody seems to be able to properly explain, 10,000 kilometer long field of melted glass raining from the sky. Yeah. And now you've got the most striking impact. And again, the dates on these events are the same. So the impacts and the glass, right? So you know this is all happening around the same period. And then, of course, the third one was this claim that there'd been some genetic engineering. I think, well, we'll ask them. The most interesting one, because it's about us, you know, if that's true, it's so profound, it's so altering of our story, that even more so than aliens come in, quite frankly, because it's one thing to say aliens came here, you know, they visited and they left, and wow, it's really cool, but they've gone. And that's, you know what I mean? That's really cool, but it's not as profound as saying, and they engineered us, right? So I'm thinking, if that bit's true, that's going to be immense. So because of my work on the other book, you know, on human origins, so I had an understanding already of kind of our story. And I know that, you know, I knew already that in the last kind of few years, there's been a radical revision and a redating of the emergence of our species. So it went from being that it was about 400,000 years ago we emerged, and like 200,000 years ago or so we diverged from Neanderthals. All of that story's gone out the window. Instead, now it's basically recognized that around about 800,000 years ago, there was a divergence from all the what we call super archaics. So like Homo erectus and anyone else that was around, there was a divergence at the genetic level that that leads to Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, Denisovans, all of the large-brained humans. Now, that breaking away event happens around 800,000 years ago. So that's recognized at the genomic level. We know that something profound happens that launches this new line that will give us all of these large-brained humans. Right on that dating. So the data they give is like 750 to 800,000 years ago. So right on our date again of 788,000 years ago, it nicely sort of wedged into that period, right? That we have the beginnings of all these lineages. And also, if you dig a bit deeper, you find that there are profound anomalies that are leading to these new people. I'll give them a fairly brief because I'm not really too technical, but I think people do need to know them because it's easy to say in it, you know, oh, ancient aliens guy believes aliens made people. You know, it's an old trope in the community. There's plenty of people that are selling the idea that, you know, ancient aliens came here and modified humans. But what they don't tend to do is make a genetic argument for this, right? They just say that we're weird, we've got big brains, and, you know, we've got chromosome 2 fusion, ergo, we must be engineered, which is a very simplistic argument. It's why it gets rejected by scientists, right? And most skeptics. But it's much more profound than that. It turns out that if you look into the human genome, particularly in the non-coding regions, and so this is what used to be called junk DNA, you look in these regions, it's not junk. Basically, these are like mostly regulatory segments. So they regulate how the genes are expressed, like whether a gene even expresses, how much it expresses, you know, they're like on-off switches, and, you know, they change how everything else works. It's super important. You've got areas in there as well that are called like highly conserved or super conserved regions. And the reason they're called that is because if you look across all mammals, you will find there are segments in that non-coding DNA that are essentially identical, no matter what animal you look at, right? Because it's doing something so profoundly important that it hasn't changed in like 100 million years, right? Because it maybe gives you lungs or something. You know what I mean? There's something that it's doing that you can't turn that off without killing the organism. So natural selection and mutation, it is not really affecting it. Well, when they started to analyze, you know, and look between humans and other animals, what they found is actually that we have hundreds of segments where these areas have been rapidly accelerated. I think we touched on it. I'll give them the same as I think I gave you before. Is the HAR1, the first one that was found, which is it was seen in, you know, compared between a chicken, a chimpanzee, and a human being. Now, it's about 118 DNA letters long, which is very short for a gene, but it's, you know, it's a short segment of code. And they looked to see, you know, what were the differences. And so they found that between a chicken and a chimpanzee, two letters had changed in 300 million years. Okay, this is your mutation rate, right? 150, well, one select, you know, selection per 150 million years is successful, right? The rest of the time, you can't change it. So you look then between the chimp and the human being, who supposedly have had 7 to 8 million years, maybe a little bit more, there should be no change. And so they expect it to be identical. Instead, 18 letters have changed. So the mutation rate had sped up so much that it was just, you know, it was just totally out of the ballpark of what should be there. And they ran their own kind of, you know, analysis over this using, you know, specialized software. And they came to the conclusion that basically there was a close to 0% chance that this could occur by any understood natural evolutionary mechanisms. That's their words, right? You know, not my thinking, although it seems obvious to me too, but that was what they kind of concluded. Now, since then, they have found hundreds of these. And not only are they, you know, they start to look at closer, but they found that over 50% of them are to do with the brain, particularly the fetal development of the human brain. Does that sound random? Doesn't sound so random if it's over 50% our amazing brain. And so that's the ones that we know. Now, that on its own, I think a lot of people say, well, you know, sounds like something's been done there, Bruce. You know, you got me there. But it doesn't stop there. That we also now, they found very recent, again, this is all recent work. They've now noted that there is profound deletions of code as well in these areas. So they said it seems like something that said are missing large segments of code. They said this should be really deleterious. It should be causing all kinds of problems. They said, but it seems that where these deletions have happened, pieces of code are now interacting that help give us our brain. What? Hang on. You know, I'm saying this should be killing us, not giving us our brain, right? So you've now got, again, unexpected acceleration, unexpected deletions, a chromosomal fusion that is beneficial, not a problem, it's beneficial. So you start to get to think, well, yeah, this is sounding a bit wacky. And then the other one they found was, and again, I think this is about a year ago, is a three-dimensional refolding of the genome. They said, so this is where the parts of the genome are now connecting to new areas. And again, guess what was helping you, Jay? I think you can guess, our brain, you know. So again, so you seem to be involved in the changes that lead to our brain. And the other thing they said is that this occurs as a singular event. It's not the product of gradual mutations. They said this has to have happened in a single generation, probably in one egg or sperm or one fetus, as it is an instant event with a total refolding, reconfiguration of the genome. Now, if you start putting these things together, you think, so all the mammals, like that we know, all them, again, this is, I'm not trying to, cherry pick here, the Zoonomia Project, which has looked across all these mammal genomes, is telling us that this is just in humans, right? Just in humans. That you look and you find that there's this three-dimensional folding, that there is, these massive number of deletions, this massive number of addition, accelerations, this chromosomal end-to-end fusion event, and it's all happening in us. And what does it do? It leads to those lineages of large-brained humans, and it occurs right on the time we're looking at for this event that we're told in this information is a visitation. Now, I don't know about you, but when you start to get, say, two or three profoundly influencing events that are aligned in time, right, that it looks connected, even without someone saying to you, oh, there was aliens. If I said to you, Jay, think about it, this is time, 788,000 years ago. I'm going to tell you a few things that happened. You tell me if you think they're connected. You've got a strange multi-directional bombardment of the planet by asteroids. You've got the emergence, the sudden genetic changes that would lead to all large-brained humans. You've got a weird crystalline rain that rains from the skies, across a 10,000-kilometer-long path. And you also have the last full geomagnetic reversal, bang on that time. That's the last time the reversal occurred. And you also have at that time the destabilizing of the ice age cycles, right, that leads to longer warm periods for human beings to form civilizations, right? Isn't that convenient too? And these are all happening at the same time. Wouldn't you feel like something odd is going on at that time?
Nah, you're just connecting dots that don't exist. Don't be silly. pseudo archaeology and science. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, these are big, significant patterns that talk towards something that actually, it's starting to feel evidential. It's fascinating to me because I haven't actually seen anyone else other than yourself digging into this tektite mystery. I didn't even hear about it until I heard about it from you on our first podcast.
Yeah, the tektite mystery, I'll be honest, I was kind of blindsided on that too. I'd never heard of it. I didn't know that. I thought I knew of most mysteries. Mm. I didn't know about the tektite mystery until I'd heard of this story and went to look if there was ever a strange rain of glass from an object, and it turned out that not only was there, but that it was a head scratcher. That, you had top scientists across loads of different disciplines, NASA engineers, loads of the guys involved with NASA, rocket scientists, top tier scientists who were saying that, well, particularly the NASA guys actually were the ones saying that we think this has to have come in from space. And they didn't agree with the impact theory. They were saying that, well, look, because when you see the shaping, and again, some people look for the tektite buttons. If you see the shaping of an Australite tektite button, it's like a nose cone of a rocket ship. Rocket scientists know about things like that, right? So they're looking at it saying, well, this is aerodynamic reshaping during entry. So we can recreate that in the NASA Ames like lab. They did. They recreated the shapes. And they realized that the only way to explain it was if a parent body broke up in orbit, and that these are pieces that carried on orbital paths, and then they glance along the atmosphere and have secondary melting, where they're reshaped into these aerodynamic shapes, and then eventually fall down. They said, well, that's a problem, because that is not what you expect from an impact. Even if the impact is powerful enough to throw material into space, it shouldn't then be in orbital paths, glancing along, these gentle paths along the atmosphere, because these are characteristic of a larger object breaking up in orbit, because we see it with satellites, things break up, they understand this, right? So they could trace back and see the reshaping has to occur in that way. Well, that leaves you a big problem, because what kind of object would be in orbit, first of all, and it has to be big, because there are billions of tons of this glass spread across 10,000 kilometers. So you've got to think an object that's probably kilometers across, right? How has it ended up in orbit, right? That's one big question, because we usually capture very small asteroids temporarily. There's no known case of very large objects, you know, being caught, either escaping again or breaking up. We don't know. We don't believe that it can happen. We don't. It's not Jupiter and other, yeah, larger bodies do this. We don't think that Earth could do that. So you've got a very unlikely event. This massive object is somehow in orbit. The second thing is, if it's not an impact, then this object is made of silica. It's made of quartz, because the material is melted quartz. So you've now got the weirdest asteroid you can think of, because it's got to be like 75% quartz crystal. What is this thing? You know, at that point, you're going to be asking yourself, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem like a normal asteroid. And then it's, you know, somehow it superheats and it's melted to liquid. Why would a natural object in the cold of space superheat to liquid, right? And then the liquid drops, they reharden into these little balls, and those carry on in orbital paths and are reshaped. I mean, there's no mechanism really for an object to superheat to liquid in space.
It's a frustrating one, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, the idea of aliens or anything like that is already put into this weird basket, even though it actually feels like logical leaps. If you remove the bias, if you remove all of your training and just look at it, it's like, okay, well, actually, that makes more sense than all of these crazy, you know, cosmological phenomena we're trying to invoke. But it's still considered more rational than the alien hypothesis, you know?
Absolutely. And this is the problem I've come up against, is that, I mean, in all the papers that I've read on this, only once was, I think it was one NASA scientist or something, said kind of like, well, what if there was an object from out of the solar system that somehow, you know, ended up in orbit? But then he kind of, you know, he does that kind of thing. But then what kind of object could end up in orbit and explode? You know, so he was like, he almost, you know.
There's like a little step there and then.
Yeah. It's like, you're so close. You just need to go one step further. But the box was too tight. You know? I mean, he couldn't quite go there. He could think that maybe we need to think of something else here, something from outside our solar system that's different and, you know, behaves in a different way. But then what kind of natural object would that be? And you know what I mean? That's the problem. If you're limiting it to natural objects, then you probably cannot invoke it, right? Because it's not behaving naturally. It's parking in orbit and then it's superheating at some point. And that's not natural.
Oh.
So they couldn't say, well, what about an alien craft? You know, they just couldn't go there. And like nobody else has gone there. And it doesn't matter that this is following the logical progression and that nobody's explained this mystery. You know, it's not like it's, well, Bruce, it's totally explained. Like, why are you trying to invoke a mystery that's not there? You know, this is recognized that it's not properly explained. And I know that I'll probably have some people, you know, trying to push back. But I can tell you now that there are elements to this that make the impact super problematic. I don't want to go into it. I'll give you one of them, because it's probably one of the main ones. So like, people say, well, okay, If it was an impact, there's a couple of things that we should see. First of all, this impact would have to be on the scale of the dinosaur killing impact, right? To put stuff back into space. Now, you'd see a global cataclysm, right? Because we know that, because we have one that kills the dinosaur, right? You know, I mean, we see this, the fingerprints of species lost, changed climate, everything when that impact occurs, right? For this event, and bear in mind, it's only 780,000 years ago, we see no traces of a global cataclysm. There is no iridium layer. There's no K2 boundary-like iridium layer that you should see all around the world in dust samples, right, in the rock. There's nothing like that. It's not in the seabed cores. Right? You find tektites there, but you don't find any layer of ash or anything like that. So there's no sign of a cataclysm. There's no sign of a species eradication in Australia or, you know, in these areas where supposedly it'll be impact. You know, so across Southeast Asia and Australia where this stuff is, there's no sort of loss of species. You know, none of those things, Jay, that you would expect from a cataclysmic impact. The other thing is the material as well. I've seen someone invoke this idea of being superheated to a certain temperature where it would allow it to liquidize in space. Basically, it's quite a complex argument. But basically, they recognize there's little fragments of crystal in the material. They say that this would be destroyed at the heats that are necessary to argue the conventional theory. So they're there. He says, in other words, it cannot be the temperatures that you invoke to explain it. So, you know, there's these little technical points where if someone was to say to me, oh, but Bruce, you know, there's mainstream people telling you you're wrong. I can tell you now, I can counter those arguments using the studies that are out there. I don't make up anything. I can just point them to a different study which will say, no, that doesn't work. And that's why it remains a mystery. So I don't know. Yeah, the thing is, and I know we've got time, but I say this, is that to me, this project has made aliens far more real. And I say uncomfortably real, where it goes from where I was used to the idea that, you know, yeah, maybe aliens are there. Maybe they're psychically contacting people. Maybe there's things flying around in our sky. But it's always a little bit on the edge of maybe, you know, you can sort of allow it to be a story, you know, maybe it's true. Maybe it's not. Maybe we're having just psychical contact. Which I think most UFO and alien contact, I think, would fall into a shamanic-y, psychical, you know, even plasmas flying around, all sorts of other stuff that we can explain a lot of the UFO and alien contact phenomena with. But this case actually really made me somewhat uncomfortable, because it's like, well, hang on, this is like actually physical aliens in a real physical craft, physically interacting with our world and changing us and our environment. And that brings it to reality in a way that I've found no other case does. Because, you know, there's always an out. But on this one, you've got the material holding your hands, you know, and you know there's a mystery to it. You can look in the genome and you can see that there's something weirdly wrong. And it all begins with an artifact that is, you know, held by the Aboriginal people. Okay, it's called a Tjuringa. That when you are near it, it seems to be able to relay information. And there is an object known to modern science, like, well, a theoretical object. It's called a Bracewell Sentinel probe. Right, it's a hypothetical alien technology that if you were an advanced species, you would leave advanced AI probes monitoring interesting planets, either in the atmosphere, you know, either orbiting or on the surface, so that you can monitor the progression of an evolving species and make contact when the time is right. I think this thing makes so much sense, like, because then they can relay and act as an ambassador to an alien civilization on multiple, you know, all around the galaxy. You could have these things sitting on planets. And so this artifact that the Aboriginal people have, particularly the Arente people, and we've got lore about this, it seems to meet those definitions. And they say it was left here in the dream time by these creator beings, and that either it was made by them or that they became it, and that it was a sentient object that is connected to the human soul in some way, and that is, you know, is hidden away, is taboo, is supposed to be only elders that can touch it. And that it has some kind of, it's also a message rock. And it, you know, so all this lore about it, when you think about it, the lore is identical to the modern story of a Bracewell probe, that, you know, they're an object that would have those characteristics, sentient, you know, with the messages in it, intelligent, you know, you have to be careful with it. It knows all sorts of stuff. So it's only the elders can interact with it. And it now wants to make contact. And one of the things that was always hypothesized, if we encountered a Bracewell probe, is it might have a complete record of the human story. Because if it's been monitoring us the whole time, it would know everything, right? It would know what happened. Because that's its purpose, is monitoring a planet. So the very story it tells us, of the lost story of our origin, is the kind of thing that we think a Bracewell probe would know. So it's again, this stuff, although it sounds on the face, it's super weird. The thing that actually gets me more is it's exactly the expectations of what we would expect in an encounter with that kind of technology. And yet, you know, the scientists are supposed to be looking for this stuff. If you sat down and said it to them, you know, that stuff you theorize and how it could happen, they don't really believe it. They're telling you, yeah, we're looking for aliens and we think they'll have probes. But if you were to sit with them, you could imagine the half smile where they thought, get this crank out of my office, even though that's what they claim they're looking for.
Just want to make everyone aware that I've recently been demonetized on YouTube. I will be able to reapply for monetization on the 26th of November. But until then, YouTube has turned the tap off in terms of being able to make advert revenue, which was quite a significant portion of my income on a monthly basis. I've had a really amazing outpour of support from people via PayPal, Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, contributing to try and help me get through this short little process of demonetization on YouTube. And I just want to say thank you so much to all of you that have already donated and given what you can. It's really much appreciated. Anyone else who's able to do that to help support my work whilst I kind of navigate through this brief period of demonetization on YouTube, that would be much appreciated. They didn't give me a solid reason why I was demonetized. It was apparently a copyright infringement, but they didn't specify the video. I tried to reappeal and they denied my reappeal. So yeah, that's my situation right now.